4.3 million Filipino Americans were either born in the U.S. or are reported to have Filipino ancestry. This podcast will feature the Filipino diaspora in the United States, tracing their origin stories and accompanying them in their journeys. Their stories will be as diverse as the dialects and subcultures of the people from across the 7,641 islands that comprise the Philippine archipelago. Some will be inspiring, others pleasant, and a few, well, cautionary. Welcome to 4 Million Filipinos, the Filipino-American Experience.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to 4 Million Filipinos. And if you have been listening, like the rest of our subscribers, we are in our final episode, not final episode of the show, but the final episode of our guest. We've had a four-part series going. Today is the fourth part. And we have Cindy Scott here, who is the author of Never Forsaken. It's a book that she wrote of her mother's life and how she came to America, and actually how she came back. But it's been a riveting story. Like I've heard from a lot of our listeners, like, when is the next episode coming? Because we always leave on a cliffhanger. And before I start, I almost forgot to welcome Bing back. Bing, how's
Hello,
it going?
Manolo. Hey, Manolo. Hey, Cindy. Hello. Yeah, we're doing okay. And then, like you, like the rest of us, I can't wait any longer. We have to get this thing started.
Yes, we become a serial podcast. Usually we have like each episode ends, but this has been great because we get to a point and then she comes back and tells more. So unfortunately, things must come to an end. So this is the wrap-up of the show.
Yeah. We've left the world of Aaron Spelling and have gone homeland already.
Yeah. Yes, definitely homeland. Oh, that's so funny. Well, Cindy, we were in a bad place when we left off in the last episode. Your mom was curled up in a ball and just gave up.
Yes.
Right? I think that's where we were.
Yes. Yeah, we ended up actually at the lowest point of her time running from, you know, for a couple years. So as you know, when there's a movie or a story, it dips down to the very lowest point. So for her, this was the lowest point. She had curled up in a ball. It was in the middle of the rainforest, completely dark, and cried herself to sleep, you know, sang that hymn to herself so she could go to sleep. But the next morning, for her, obviously God had heard her prayer, because the next morning, in the middle of the rainforest, the sun shone through the trees, and Marion and the two girls had slept well, and the next morning, it was completely different. So picture that, it's completely dark, then all of a sudden, the sun is shining through a rainforest. And you know what that's like. A rainforest is so dark, there's a covering over it. The sun doesn't shine through. That's why it's a rainforest. So this was their third day of running and going through the rainforest. Of course, you know, they had no shoes. Can you imagine just your bare feet, you know, walking on rocks and trying to go up mountains and down ravines? And for this is the third day. So by afternoon, the Sabanos actually brought them to a clearing on the mountain slope. And there was a neep hut, an abandoned neep hut. And this was the safe place for them. This was where her brother David was going to keep them for as long as he could, of course, during the rest of the war. Remember, they didn't know how long the war was going to be. We do, because we know the end of the story. So they're now on the slope. Sabanos take them. They find this Nipa hut that's been abandoned, and they actually live there. Now you have to buy the book, remember, so you can read all these stories on Never Forsaken,
right? That's right.
But they stay there from March of 1944, actually until the Americans come. But they get there and there's no food. And Bing, I remember you saying that Mindanao was full of what'd you say? Vegetation and yes.
Mindanao is called the land of promise after all. I mean, there's a lot. It provides a lot of food for the Philippines. There's water. There's from the land. There's just so much. There's so much there. So I guess if there's any place to, you know, escape, run away from, at the very least, if you were there in Mindanao,
you could live off something to eat. You could live off the land, basically.
Forage. Yeah.
Well, they got there.
And the waters.
And there was no food and no water. So they had to forage, and her brother David eventually came with monkeys to eat, wild pigs to eat, but no water. So he went and looked for water, and he eventually found some water down the mountain. In a ravine, there was a stream. So here they are, no water.
Wow.
They walk down the mountain to the ravine, and David and the Sabanos take bamboo poles. They find bamboo poles, and they take out the inside partitions, and they put water in those bamboo poles, and get this, okay? They carry those bamboo poles, lifted up a few inches off the ground, and you can just picture this, and they carry those bamboo poles, balanced it on their shoulder, up the mountain. These young girls, they could have water. They couldn't tip that bamboo pole because then they would lose the water. That is how they got the water, up and down the mountain.
It's amazing. Well, there's so many amazing parts, right? A, they found a place that was safe, right? I mean, all of this is an answer to prayer and things like that. But I mean, you just have to think about how everything lined up for them to survive. They're near water. I mean, you still have to bring it to them. They have an abandoned place, which is now safe house for them. So it's unbelievable.
Well, Marion and the two girls were with the Sabanos, but her mother and Helen followed with David because they couldn't walk as fast. Remember, they had to carry Helen, who was crippled with polio, in a hammock. And my Lola, couldn't walk fast. So David walked with them, and then eventually they arrived later that evening at the Nipah. Mm-hmm. But as the days went on, David told them a half a mile away from that Nipah was a U.S. radio station. So hidden in the middle of the rainforest were scouts that General MacArthur had sent by submarine, and they were only a half a mile away. And eventually, these soldiers became very good friends with my mom. I mean, one of those soldiers, Donato Herrera, was an American scout, and that's where they got the news. But eventually, you know, they planted that land, got some crops going, and the soldiers would come and get some food from them, and they would also go to the radio station. So it was for a few months, this is what they did up there, but they were completely safe during that time in the Sneepa Hut.
Wow. So the Donato Herrera was a Filipino scout or an American scout?
Actually American. We have a picture in the book, and he actually has an American uniform on.
Okay.
So he was one of the scouts, but he was a part of the American military sent by General MacArthur. And they, you know, they came in submarines, of course, to the island. That's how they got to Mindanao, so they would not be caught by the Japanese.
And then they kind of swam up onto the shore. That's amazing. I didn't know that. I only saw that in James Bond stuff. I didn't realize it was for real.
No, remember, this is a true story. Boy. This is not fiction, okay?
I know. Well, I'm telling you, this could be a movie.
You can't make this up.
That's the next thing, a Netflix movie, I'm telling
you. Right, okay, so we need to find somebody. But during this time, there's a parallel story with the fight for Manila.
Okay.
You know, my Uncle Johnny, mom's brother-in-law, and her sister Mary were right in the middle of the bombing and the Japanese and the Americans coming. If you know some of your history, how Manila was bombed and how the Japanese came to Manila. So Uncle Johnny had been a POW, the same camp where the Bataan soldiers were kept. He got very ill and taken to the hospital. Well, the Japanese decided that the sick people would be released. Well, he just happened. Wow. He had malaria. And he was one of those released, and he was able then to go back into this home in Manila with my Aunt Mary. It's an amazing story. I'm not going to tell you the story because, you know, I would have to go on and on. But there is a section called The Fight for Manila that's going on at the same time while they are in the rainforest.
Okay. And that's basically when Manila was declared an open city. And so that's what parallels that, what's going on over there. Okay.
Yes, yes. An interesting bit of history. If you remember the name Colonel Fertig, I had mentioned him before, actually. He was, and Bing, you might know a little bit about him because he was a hero to the Filipinos after World War II. He was the commander of the guerrilla forces for Mindanao. But when the Japanese came and invaded Mindanao, Colonel Fertig actually went to live with the Moros in Lanao, the same Moros group that my mom lived with. Isn't that amazing?
Wow. It is.
It is.
They
such a, you know, it just ties it up.
Yeah.
So very, very neatly yet, wow. Yeah. What a way.
So many things, like I said earlier, so many things had to line up for this to be successful.
Well, the other
in the meantime, they have no idea what's going on. Like, that just blows my mind, is how they can keep hope, because you don't know how long the war is going to last. You don't know how much time you have to prepare for. And I think that's just a testament to your mother and how strong she was.
That's right. And so, it was
and I guess it's also a testament. One of the underlying themes of this is really from the title itself, it's really a book of faith.
Yes.
That, you know, physically, you just can't imagine all the odds that they had to go through. I mean, just from carrying alone one daughter who's stricken with polio, to just the entire place being, you know, not domesticated, so inhospitable, you know, walking bare feet, and when you're not used to that. So it's an entirely different experience. But, you know, it shows the human spirit, and it also shows the power of faith, because it's just something which they just had to believe in to keep going.
They did.
We can't imagine that right now, but
I know it's such a different world that we live in today than back then.
In
a
world where everything is almost available,
helping each other, right, to survive.
That's right.
Which, when you look at, yeah, never mind. We don't want to get into how crazy the world is today.
Well, you know, just trying.
Oh yeah.
Trying to picture them back then with no, hardly any news. They did get some news from the American soldiers, of course, about when, you know, say when the Americans came or the Japanese were here or there, some radio news. But, you know, they lived there for a few months from, like I said, March 1944. But then also David would bring them guerrilla money. I don't know if you know that money, because the Japanese actually had their own money, but then the guerrillas made their own money, which was actually backed by the Philippine National Bank. So after the war, this guerrilla money is actually still good. It was currency.
No kidding.
So that's how they circulated and bought items, you know, by the guerrillas. So David brought Mary and mom and the girls some money. So they were able to walk to a village. Get this, 3 hours to a village. They used that money to buy salt because they, you know, they had nothing. And remember, nothing for their teeth. You know, they couldn't take care of anything, and salt is what they used. It was such a valuable item back then. We don't think about that today. We can buy salt at the grocery store. But salt back then was so valuable to them. So they had some currency.
Well, that's Well, that's where the word salary comes from, right? Salt is the origin of that, because really, even way back then, from the time of the Romans, salt was such an important commodity. You know, it's what they used to preserve food. It was used for so many things, and that's why people's wages, their work for the day, that's why you're paid. Are you worth your own salt?
Wow,
that's where the expression comes from, and the word salary comes from sal. Salt.
Wow, I just learned something new today, Bing. I'm so impressed.
Yeah, sometimes Bing can really be a good teacher.
Well, thank you for that. But then one day in late 1945, they heard the sound of planes, and they sounded different. They weren't Japanese planes. They were American planes. So they could tell the difference between Japanese planes and American planes. And so when they heard these planes overhead, over their area, oh my gosh, they were just, you know, Marion, my mom was just shouting, Americans are back, they're back. And she took a white towel actually from the house and waved it to see if the Americans could see them. They were so thrilled, embracing one another. Can you just imagine what that day was like when...
No.
Yeah.
From the darkness of everything, and then suddenly there's a glimmer of hope.
Right.
Absolutely. So when they found that the Americans were there, David then took them back down to Asamas, and the sight of American soldiers was the most beautiful sight in the world to them at that point. And, you know, they went to Iligan. I mentioned that it's the port city. But I want to read you a phrase that my mom wrote. One never knows what freedom is really like until it is lost, if only for a time.
Very true.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You never know what you've got until it's gone.
Absolutely. Yeah. And to them, that was like heaven, seeing the tanks, the American trucks, the soldiers. You know, it was freedom.
Is this when MacArthur comes back? I don't remember my war
MacArthur
history.
Came back to Leyte before that. And he said, you know, people of the Philippines, I'm back, something along that line. You know, there's the very famous picture of him landing in Leyte, walking on the beach after he said, I shall return. And now remember, Lola had all these very important papers around her waist in her pouch. And they wanted to go back to the plantation, but the plantation was no longer there because it had been looted by the Moros and the Japanese. So that town of Mamungan that they lived in with all the American veterans, it was all gone. No place to go to. Wow. No place to go home to, because it was all gone. What's interesting today, if you look at a map, that plantation and that whole area, Bing, you've mentioned this, it's the lake covers it. It's the electrical power that powers Marawi.
Yes. That's there's a huge, if I'm mistaken, this is the falls in it's the Agus
River.
It's the Agus Dam. Yes, that's the dam, and it provides a lot of the electrical requirements of Marawi and that immediate area.
Yes, but
so yeah, it.
But picture it today. Way back then, that's where the plantation was. So the plantation is now under, it's underwater.
It's underwater.
But when you look at a map, there are still a lot of coconut trees in the area. And you know, coconut trees last for a long time. I mean, coconut trees could live to be 100 years. So personally, I wouldn't be surprised if some of those coconut trees that are there today were there back in the 1920s and 30s.
Yeah. Yeah, that's absolutely possible.
So how many years were the Japanese occupying the Philippines? Was it four?
Four.
5 years?
1941 to 1945. So the Americans actually landed at different times at different islands. Mindanao was the last island that the Americans came to. So the Americans actually started landing, I think it was, I believe, in November of 1944 in different areas. But the last one that was liberated was Mindanao in April of 1945. So, you know, you can just picture this in the port town of Iliga and all the Americans and trucks. And there were eventually doctors that were there that helped to give medicine to these American civilians and other civilians. And, you know, they had had no medicine doctors for 4 years. I mean, the last time she saw a dentist was way before, years before. And a lot of her teeth had broken off or fallen out because they had no care for it. So American doctors took care of them, you know, and that was such, for them, that was such a saving moment for them. And there were three things that she said actually during this time that kind of, she summed it up in three words: faith, courage, and strength, because she had faith in a God who knew who would not let her down. She knew this deep in her spirit and her heart. Courage to start a new path to her new dreams, because you have to start over. And strength to stand firm no matter the obstacles. So here she is, and she thinks in the very foremost of her mind, I have to do something with my life. What am I going to do? I want to get an education. I want to go to the U.S. And maybe my father still has some family there. I don't know. So her sister, she had to get permission. Her mother said, you're not going over my dead body. Are you going to the U.S.?
Oh, really?
So, but she was determined to start a new life, because there was really not much left for her to do for them. Everything was gone, you know, at this point for them.
Right.
So she really wanted to go to the U.S. And in June of 1945, there was a cargo plane, a U.S. cargo plane, actually going to Leyte. So she thought, you know, I'm going to get on this cargo plane. And they had no clothes, really. I mean, the army gave them some fatigues. So an aunt of mine. Oh, so I'm sorry. The plane was actually on its way to Manila, but it was rerouted to Leyte. So she had wore these fatigues, army clothes, because they had no clothes.
Right.
Swear. So soldiers gave them some army clothes, and her sister cut it down, and that's what she wore. So she was very determined to do this. So now they're all at Camp Keithley, because Camp Keithley actually, remember, it was a camp at the beginning, U.S. Army camp. Then the Japanese made it a POW camp, and that's where they were POWs at that camp. And then now it's back to being a U.S. Army camp.
Right. Okay.
So this is where the civilians, the American veterans, were processed through. Everyone had to check in and kind of get their names off the list, you know, checked off.
Right.
And so she was determined to go to the U.S.
Did she have to show any kind of citizenship papers or anything? Like, how did they know that she was an American?
Yes, citizen? That's actually a really good question. So while they were signing in, and you can just picture this, there's an American soldier with a list with their names. And while she's checking in, she gives her name as Marion Gent. And I was not going to tell you this part of the story because it's really, this is an amazing, amazing story. So I was going to keep it a secret, but I changed my mind. I thought I would tell you anyway.
Okay.
You can
leave stuff out. I mean, we know we want people to read the details in the book, but
so he's checking her in, and she gives her name as Marion Gent, you know, G-H-E-N-T. And he says to her, Marion, how did you get the name Gent? Well, so then she tells him, you know, her father was a veteran of the Spanish-American War, and then she pulls out the papers. And she shows it to him. As you can see in these papers, his name was William Gent from Kentucky. And he says to her, well, you know, that is so interesting because all the Gents are related and my mother is a Gent. He goes, let me write to her and see if she has any information. So his name is Carl Mack.
Wow.
He writes to her and she writes back to her son Carl and says, yes, that's my older brother, but we thought he had been dead for 50 years.
Oh my God. Really?
Isn't that amazing? Okay, that is incredible. So, of course, you know, mom was speechless. How, I mean, this is, they're cousins.
What
first
are the chances?
Cousins.
What are the odds? Right.
What are the chances of that happening? They were first cousins, and you know, his mom thought that her papa, William Gent, had been dead for 50 years. Because way back when, after the Spanish-American War, when he was in the US, he went back to Kentucky where he was born to look for his relatives, but they had moved. So no one was left in the area, and he didn't know where they went after the war. So they didn't know where he was. And so he ended up, of course, being in the Philippines and never knew where they were. So can you imagine this? This is a movie. This is a movie. This is
a Pinoy movie.
Okay, Bing. You if you know somebody in the Philippines, okay, we can connect with them. But anyway, it was hard to believe. So what happened is she gets on this plane then on the way to Manila, but it stops in Leyte, and she gets the plane and she gets on the plane, stops in Leyte, and there is a ship bound for the U.S., a Navy ship called the USS Brewster. And knowing that she has some kind of family in the U.S. gave her such hope. So she decides to go to the United States, and she goes on this ship called the USS Brewster with her fatigue.
And it's just her.
Just her.
By herself.
By herself.
And how old is she?
She's now 19.
At this point?
But you know, just remember,
that's still crazy.
She has had no school for 4 years. She's been living in the forest and the jungle and running from the Japanese for 4 years. So she's 19, but she's lost so much weight, she looks like a 14-year-old.
Wow.
But so she...
And at the same time, this entire experience must be so new to her. So from 4 years on the run in vegetation, pretty much in the wild, because they're running, and then all of a sudden, you know, to be brought into at that point, what must have been the first stop must have been such a cosmopolitan scare for her. You know, seeing all of these buildings, seeing all of these moving vehicles, all of a sudden, must have been wow, so different from what she had, you know, from what she had experienced over the last 4 years.
It was actually so, you know, she boarded the ship to go to the U.S., but you know, she didn't know what to do. She just kind of went along with the crowd. So she climbed that ship just like the soldiers. You know, you've seen the picture, a net, soldiers climbing up. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what she had to do. She climbed that net onto the ship. And she had also met two mestizos, while she was in Ligon, and these two other girls had fathers in the U.S. So they were also boarding the ship. So they boarded the ship called the USS Brewster. That ship actually had been commissioned in April 1945. So here she is on the ship. They get on the ship and they show them to their quarters. They feed them and they're so hungry. Can you imagine not having a lot of food and how thin she was? They were starving. Right. So the military soldiers fed them and they were eating so much that they actually got the nickname Chow Hounds.
That's awesome. not exactly a nice thing to listen to, but hey, I can imagine why.
They were Chow Hounds.
Now it's a delivery app.
That's right. You're right. Well, that's probably where they exactly got the term. Chow Hounds from, you know, World War II on a Navy ship. That's actually a good piece of trivia I'd like to find out. So
I wonder how long was the trip across the ocean?
It was, I believe it was 3 weeks. I believe that the trip was
wasn't too bad.
But, you know, they had their drills because there were other ships that actually escorted the USS Brewster. Remember, there were still Navy ships around. You know, there could have been mines in the ocean.
Right.
Submarines there. So they were escorted by escort ships, I guess that's what they were called, to the Philippines. But, you know, their first island that they came to was actually Hawaii. So they came to Hawaii.
Okay.
And then from Hawaii, they sailed into San Francisco. So on the eve of Labor Day, which is September 2nd, but the eve, the night before, they came in, like Bingy was saying, they came into San Francisco where there were lights. I mean, she was just, it was like going to Disneyland today.
Yeah.
You know?
I can imagine.
It was just all lit up. The moon was shining. And the next day on September 2nd, 1945, Labor Day, they actually got off the ship onto San Francisco. But on that same day, was the same day that the Japanese surrendered on the USS Missouri.
Wow.
In Tokyo Bay. So they were told that news on the ship. Can you imagine them hearing that the war had just ended?
It must have been such celebration, right? I can't even.
Oh, yes. I mean, they were just celebrating and, you know, it was Labor Day and she recalls them getting off the ship and the Red Cross had actually given them $100 each. And can you imagine what $100 is today?
That's pretty good for 1945.
It is.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great start.
Hey, right now it would, you know,
$100 even now, right $100 now, is
even
great.
Now would be good.
Yeah. That's right.
That's a full tank of gas right now. So
yeah, today it is. But
that's right.
The Red Cross gave them $100 each so they could get some clothes, you know, buy some food. Because before they even got on the ship, they still had no shoes. She actually bought a pair of very thin shoes while she was on the ship because the ship had what you would call a PX. You know, there's in the military, it's PX, it's a post exchange. And being in the Air Force, where Wayne was in the Air Force 29 years, it's called the BX, the base exchange.
Okay.
That's right.
See what you're learning today? Isn't it amazing? But even today, it's still called a P. The Navy still calls it a PX.
That's right. And, you know, there's well, several years ago, there was a huge market here in the Philippines for a lot of goods that came in from the States via the PX system. So yeah, and they were called PX goods. And a lot of them were, you know, were sought after back in the day when, you know, goods from all over the world weren't as easily available here.
Right.
So there.
Well, you had Clark Air Force Base on
That's right, that's right.
Where was it? It was
Clark was in the north in Pampanga, and of course beside Clark, well, not too far away, was also Subic.
Yes, Subic Bay. And I actually recall Subic Bay because my uncle, remember, was the Commodore of the Philippine Navy from 1962 to 1964. So we used to go on his yacht and go fishing. And then we used to go stay with him in Baguio and Puro Point. So those were just some of the benefits being related to him. But yeah, so another story later on is why we came to the States. But anyway, so Mom, the Red Cross gave the money, put her on a train from San Francisco to Los Angeles, where at the train station, she met her aunt and uncle for the first time. So to find out, that's just amazing.
Well, I can't, how does that even register with you? It's like you've never met these people before. Now they're your only family in the place where your father grew up. It just continues to be an amazing story. But so she, I'm just going to backtrack a little bit. So she found out where they lived. They made contact. And then basically made her way to the United States. And even, you know, she's still 19 mm-hmm. years old. I mean, this is still the same year. And so then she still has to make her way all the way to Kentucky by herself. Never being on a train before in the U.S. Like, it just, all of these things is just amazing that she was able to navigate and get around on her own to meet her family.
But then again, Manolo, yeah, it is. But isn't that really the stuff that you see in the movies? This is essentially the retelling of the immigrant tale. People coming
it
in
is.
From lands of
it is.
Of hard from different places. So this was just an immigrant's tale coming in from the Philippines. But I think the same has been was true also of the Italians, mm-hmm. the Irish, and many other mm-hmm. people, and you know, who sought their own dreams in you know mm-hmm. in the United States. So it's an amazing story, but one that mm-hmm. that actually has been told mm-hmm. many different times, many mm-hmm. different places.
Mm-hmm. I think what
did she meet anybody on the train? Like, did she make friends?
She met a woman who befriended her and helped her actually mm-hmm. at the train depot to find her aunt and uncle. And then there was a young man, a few years younger than her, who was from the same town of Mamungan, who was actually on the train with her and was there to also meet somebody else. But they were on the train together. But it was a pretty lonely time. You know, you're not sure where you're going. I mean, there's the fear and excitement at the same time in your heart. You're excited, but you're also scared. You know, what to me is a privilege when you read this book, by the way. Mm-hmm. It's like reading a private journal because you are right there with her and you feel what she's going through. And I think that that's what makes this book really special. And I think I've mentioned, I am not a professional author. And, you know, this is like my only book, but you are right there with her. Her thoughts, her feelings, and you're in this journey with her.
And you know what makes it special as well, Cindy, is that, you know, in the backdrop of you know trouble in different parts of the world right now, it humanizes this whole notion of war, of conflict. You know, we sometimes right now, because of media, we tend to consume it as series of numbers mm-hmm. and you know we think of it in terms of casualty rates and people who are displaced and all of that and we're because it's happening right in front of us on television every single time we mm-hmm. tune in, you know, we seem to numb ourselves to this, but really beyond the headlines of the conflict, these are the stories of ordinary mm-hmm. people, and I'm glad that you're able to put this to writing, to share it with people, because it really speaks of the horror and the trouble with conflict. Mm-hmm. There will always be people that the leaders do not know, whose lives are affected. And, you know, it also tells us that each one has a story to tell. Yep. And you know, it's not, war is not just about soldiers in the front lines. It's not just of limbs getting torn mm-hmm. apart. It's also of people who are just getting mm-hmm. lost. Mm-hmm. And in your case after that, and in your mom's case after that, getting found.
Absolutely. And she finds her aunt and uncle, and I'll kind of shorten it. You'll have to read the book so you can read all the experiences. But she, at 19 years old, you know, she was determined to get an education. So she lived with her aunt and uncle here in Temple City, California. And she went back to high school at 19 years old while all the other kids were 4 years younger than her.
Good for her.
So she was determined. She went to Alhambra High School. She took night classes. So it was going to take her 3 years to graduate, but she took night classes. So after those night classes, the school officials actually had her graduate in 2 years. So instead of 3 years, she finished high school in 2 years. So at the age of 21, mm-hmm. while everybody else is 17 or 18, she finishes high school in Alhambra High School. And she then applies to college. She gets accepted to a university called Biola. And I don't know if you've heard of it. It's actually a Christian university. Back then, it was called the Bible Institute of Los Angeles. It was in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And she was accepted to that school. But here's another amazing part of the story. That somebody paid for her tuition and lodging. And to this day, till the day she died, she never knew who it was.
Oh, you're kidding.
No. That is incredible. Someone paid for all of it. And she had a thought, maybe it was somebody from Canada, because occasionally she would get like mm-hmm. a postcard from Canada. But no, she never knew to this day who it was. And wow. So she ended up going to college, to Biola, mm-hmm. Visited a church, attended a church, met a young lady. And this young lady's parents kind of adopted mom and had mom live with them during her college years. They were very wealthy. They lived in a wealthy town of San Marino here in California, and they were Texas. They were oil owners in the state of Texas. So they were very wealthy, and they take my mom in, wow. and she lives with them. And during this time, my mom is not used to, you know, she's been in the war. They had a live-in maid, so she learned how to set the table or, you know, how to cook, how to fine dine. I mean, this was something that she had no idea how to do. So, right. you know, for these few years, that's what she did. And then she ended up connecting with her father's family in the state of Washington. And she took the bus from Los Angeles to Washington State, visited them. You have to read the book, all her experiences. And her cousins owned a 1,000-acre ranch in Washington. And the Columbia River wow. goes right through it. Here she is. She visits them and she stays with them all summer long during her college break. And mm-hmm. she lives on a ranch with them. You know, she learns how to bake pies and make bread with them and swim in the Columbia River. So it was such a different experience. And one of her aunts was actually married to the descendant of Daniel Boone.
No.
So I'm assuming.
Of course. Why not? At this point.
I'm almost tempted to say, You're making this up.
Yeah, right.
So
yes.
The funniest part of this story is, on my end, eventually my husband and I went to visit the Daniel Boone home, and I went in there, and I told them that my mother was, you know, related to Daniel Boone. And they look at me and they just wouldn't believe me. I said, no, my cousins have 8 of Daniel Boone's rifles, and they only had 2 at Daniel Boone's house. And my cousins have all of Daniel Boone's tools also that have been handed down from generation to generation. And we actually saw them because we went to visit that cousin. That's pretty amazing.
No kidding.
So why? Yes. They wouldn't believe me, you know? So,
goodness. She.
This episode has just gone on a different tangent.
Right. Well, I mean, we said it was going to end on a good note. So everything, you know, all the hardship is behind her. And now she's finding out she's a descendant of Daniel Boone. And in fact,
I'm waiting for us to get on to hear some music from Pat Boone and then.
Yeah,
or Debbie Boone.
Debbie Boone.
Well, you,
no, different Boone.
Different Boone. Bang. You have to go to Western American history to read about Daniel Boone.
No. I know. But the thing is, this is taking so many twists and turns right now that I'm not surprised. We're going to end there as well.
Right.
It just got different places all.
That's why you have to read the story. There are stories in between.
Right. That's right.
So, you know, she...
She graduates.
And stories that sprout from
right.
it.
She graduated from Biola. And she then decides to go back to the Philippines because she hasn't seen her brothers and sisters, some of them, for 10 years. Remember, she never saw them during the war. They all were scattered. And she hadn't seen her... Mama, her mother, in 5 years. So she graduates and she decides, I want to go back to the Philippines. So she ends up going back to the Philippines to visit them on Manila and Mindanao. And just think about this. She comes full circle.
Cindy, I just wanted to say what I would give for a before and after photo.
Yes. And I do have that.
Man.
But I do want to read you the last allegory, because do you remember I read
yes.
an allegory? It's an yes. allegory about the Agus River. So this is the last okay. allegory that I'm going to read to you. Now, remember, she's back in the Philippines now, okay? After the war, after graduation, she climbs up out of the water onto the shore, coughing. Sputtering, eyes stinging, arms and legs cut and bruised, and muscles sore, but still breathing, still landing, not beaten, alive. She stands up and lets the warm sun wash over her face, lets it melt away the cold, lets it wash away the darkness, the pain, the fear. You didn't take me. You couldn't take me. The roar is gone now. No more deafening screams. No more visions of flailing arms protruding from the angry waters. The raging river is now little more than a stream. Calm. Peaceful. She had won. Then the first faltering step onto ground warmed by the sunshine. The first step into a new life. Into new things. Into new hope. She is home. That's the last allegory
beautiful,
of the book.
Beautiful.
And then as you continue to read in the book, there's an epilogue of what happens to her after this time. I'm not going to tell you about it. She does end up coming, you know, getting married in the U.S., going back from the Philippines to the U.S. eventually, but she does marry in the Philippines and stays there for a very long time until 1964. And she comes back to America with her family, which includes me, because my Uncle David was working for President Marcos, had a fallout with him, and so the Gent family... It was not safe for us to stay. So in 1964, we as a family, and we didn't have anything, nothing, just a suitcase of clothes, sold everything and then came to the U.S. And that's another story. But what's interesting is that I have to tell you, when my mom was in Biola College, her last year at the college, she had a Japanese roommate. And through this Japanese roommate, my mom actually forgave what the Japanese had done. And God used this Japanese roommate in her last year of college to live with her in the dorms. Okay, that's amazing. Because she had so much anger in her heart.
Yeah.
And hate.
A lot of that, of course, right? I think, you know, my grandfather wouldn't even let me buy any kind of Japanese cars.
Really?
For that reason. Like, he felt like that's how angry he was. Yes. So, I mean, but, I can't even, yeah, I mean, no, it's true. That's just, of course, par for the course of this story, because, you know, the forgiveness and the healing that your mom probably went through that year probably
and I guess
her
that's, and I guess that's really, you know, that's a fitting close to that chapter, because, mm-hmm. you know, the story of faith, forgiveness is always, I think, an important part of a story of faith. And mm-hmm. You know, it's just amazing that happened, and then she had that roommate, because really, a story of faith like that can't just be all about triumph. There's really that magnanimity mm-hmm. that has to be part of it, and the forgiveness, and you know, it ends in a quieter yet more peaceful way, the story. And wow. And it teaches a lot.
The other thing that's interesting is that my dad, my mom's Marion's husband, and that's a story in the book too, but in 1962, he and my uncle David, who was the gorilla that I've talked about all this time, actually had mm-hmm. a company. They formed a company, and that company exported logs from Mindanao to Japan. So my dad would go to Japan and made several trips to Japan. And can you imagine the change? That's 1962, 1964. That's where they did. And the logs were from Mindanao. So there's this amazing end to that part. You know, before she and her family come back to the U.S. But you can't live life without forgiveness.
Exactly. It's not good. It'll eat you up. So anyway, I think I'm looking at the time. Unfortunately, we have to wrap it up. And Cindy, we loved the story. We're going to have you back to tell your story, because it's just as interesting. And I think that's another way to lead into, you got to keep listening to our show, because we're going to have her back and she'll tell her story, which is just as amazing. And if you are listening and you want to get the book, you can get it on Amazon. You can also, what was that the other one, other site?
Rakuten?
Oh, yes. Oh, Rakuten. Rakuten? Yes. Yeah, you can find it on Rakuten if you're out of the U.S. And you can also go to her website, which is www.cydpublishing.com.
Yes.
And I mean, just Google the book and you'll see all the great reviews. It's Never Forsaken. And it's just an amazing story of Cindy's mom and how she lived through World War II, made it to the U.S., finding her long lost family, and they lived happily ever after. It's just one of those stories. So as dark as it gets really bright mm-hmm. at the end. So I think it's something worthwhile. I recommend it to everyone. Cindy, thank you so much. And we will have you back.
I am so honored and privileged.